take a look at grading in the course's approach and in turn teachers' opportunities to approach issues of academic honesty. We'll turn things back over to Aaron then to walk us through the grading philosophy of the course, and then we'll group into smaller groups and actually do some hands-on calibration so that when you leave here, ultimately you'll have a sense of what you can look for, what you should look for, and what tools you'll have to support you toward that end. So in terms of how we approach this particular goal of evaluation, it really is along these three axes, which you've now heard a couple of times. Correctness, design, style. Correctness is perhaps the most objective. Does it meet the course's specifications? And for that, we have Check 50, the command line tool with which you can, and the submission tool will automatically grade the correctness of your student scores that you can, if you so choose, override if you realize, oh, they really shouldn't be penalized this much because of just one missing semicolon or such, but otherwise the data is pre-populated. Style will be the same as well, whereby we will have a CS50 style guide. You might agree or disagree with it, but at least it's a rule of thumb against which we can compare students' code, and the tool will adjudicate whether or not it's consistent with that style. But there too, you can override things as needed, especially if you'd prefer your student style their code in some other way. But design is by far the most qualitative and the most subjective, and really the best opportunity to continue the teaching process even after students have submitted their work. But of course, if you have 100 or even more students, this can be a very daunting, if not untenable, task. But there is going to be software support for this in the grading process if you so choose. So in particular, you'll see, if you haven't seen already, a close look at the GitHub user interface, which is traditionally used in industry for code reviews, providing feedback on colleagues' own work. And we use that exact same process here on campus and at Yale for providing students with more qualitative feedback on their code. So this is just a generic screenshot from GitHub's own UI. But what's really nice about this very simple idea of a feature is that when students submit their code via Submit 50 and in turn to GitHub, you will then have access to see their code in GitHub's user interface. And you can comment on any one of the lines just by clicking a little plus icon next to that line of code. Wonderfully, the student is immediately notified via email, so long as he or she has provided an email address in registering for GitHub. And if he or she wants to engage in you in a conversation and ask for clarification or to explain his or her design decisions, it'll be a very sticky interaction via both the GitHub website as well as via email. So it's a wonderful mechanism for staying engaged so that the process of grading is not only evaluative, but it actually can spark a conversation if you so choose. Even if you just do this pseudo-randomly during a week or occasionally during the semester, realize that infrastructure is there. But as for the matter of academic honesty, this is a mouthful, so we'll email out things like this after you, so don't have to transcribe the URL. But over the years, has CS50 developed a very detailed policy when it comes to academic honesty, mostly so that based on experience, we have addressed proactively any of the various scenarios that might arise. But in essence, and as we present it to students verbally in short form, it really boils down to be reasonable. And this, of course, can be interpreted in any number of ways, and so what the policy then proceeds to do is to elaborate on what it means in life to be reasonable, or at least so far as the course is concerned. And so, for instance, this is just an excerpt from the course's syllabus. But in addition to stating that students be reasonable, this is a good rule of thumb that really distills the few couple hundred words that the policy might ultimately have that allows students to ask classmates and others for help, so long as that help does not reduce to another doing your work for you. And perhaps as students get older and as they become teachers and adults, this is sort of goes without saying, but certainly doesn't necessarily go without saying the first time students have experienced it. And then this heuristic too tends to apply well. Generally speaking, when asking for help, you may show your code to others, but you may not view theirs. And so we are eager to encourage students to collaborate and to discuss with another on both code they have working and code they have not working. But the general idea is that if two students are collaborating in a reasonable way, side by side, for instance, if one student is struggling to figure out some bug or get something working, it's OK for his or her friend to look at their screen and say, oh, you are missing a semicolon, or maybe you really shouldn't be using a do while loop there, or whatever the counsel might be. But the solution should not be for the struggling student student to say, well, let me just see how you did it, which would cross the line that we ourselves have drawn in the sand. And so that rule alone rather characterizes the course's overall philosophy as it relates to issues of academic honesty. But the reality is, at the end of the day, we see from 0 to 10% of the class crossing these various lines. This almost always boils down to situations where students, in our case, at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., typically the night before a deadline, are super stressed, very lacking in sleep, having a lot of commitments on their shoulders, personal extenuating circumstances, any number of things, but it all reduces to making a split-second poor decision in the middle of the night. And so we have approached this in any number of ways. One of the things I think I'm most proud of our having debuted a few years ago is what we describe as our regret clause. The language for this is at that same longer URL. And in essence, this says to students, if you do cross one of these lines and behave in a way that's considered unreasonable, then come forward within 3 days, 72 hours of doing this. The number there being somewhat arbitrary, but being sort of a reasonable heuristic so that by then, surely they've had a time to sleep, to wake up, to think on what they might have done some night before. And then come forward to me or one of the course's heads and just own up to it and explain what you did or ask if what you did was indeed over the line. And then we have a conversation about it, a teachable moment, ideally, if you will. It's not without repercussions. We will typically, in situations where we or I agree that, yeah, that was over the line, you should not have been looking at that GitHub repo online, we'll zero the problem set in question. We'll have a conversation. But ideally, we'll have some form of intervention, as has indeed happened. We've ended up engaging with the student's permission, like their resident advisor on campus, because there were familial issues going on or interpersonal issues or the like, or even health reasons. And so it's been a good way of sort of detecting that early on. They still get the problem set zeroed, for instance, in that case. But we don't escalate it to sort of the highest levels of college level disciplinary action. And I think that's been a very healthy way of dealing with this. It's been a much more time-consuming approach, and it hasn't reduced, frankly, the number of cases we see, but it has targeted, I think, a demographic where there really is an opportunity to learn and benefit from that conversation. We still see some 0 to 10% of the class crossing a line nonetheless. Some of us got to chatting the other night as to why our numbers are the way they are, and it's a few things. We, for instance, put a lot of time into this process, both at Harvard and Yale, disciplining up to 5 or 10% of the class each year. But these days, this is because we have pretty much decided that, yes, there's no way these lines of code did not happen without there being some undue act, copying and pasting from another student or commonly from some GitHub repo. And it almost always is the sort of foolish smoking guns that catch our attention. It's when a comment is misspelled or something is transposed. And it's not just that the code is similar, as is going to happen with Mario and Greedy and Caesar. There's only so many ways that similar students with similar backgrounds are going to come to some solution. It's because they both had the same English error in their comments, or they both called their variables exactly the same thing in a very curious way and the like. And so we happen to have software that facilitates detection of these kinds of things as a first pass. Those are tools we'll make available to you as well. It's not a manual process, but it's not computers that ultimately decided how to act. It's a gauntlet, in our case, of at least three of us here on campus, or one or more of you, if you want a second pair of eyes, that might be able to take a look at something like this. And only once we are comfortable that, yeah, this just didn't happen by chance, do we ourselves decide to escalate things. So that's how we approach it. It's a mix of tools and sort of human judgment. But I think the best things we have done over time, as per something like the regret clause, has to use it not so much for the disciplinary action that it might otherwise be, but really for the intervention that it affords us. So with that said, usually at this point, once we've had a very serious chat and lecture, I'll put up a picture of like a cat or a kitten on the screen to just kind of dispel the tension. I didn't think of that this time, but so let me just give you Aaron now.
Hi, everyone. So later today, we're going to actually have a chance to look at some of the practice piece sets that you might be grading and sort of discuss with your peers what types of scores you might give and how to justify those scores to students and being consistent and all of that good stuff. But in order to do that, we need your GitHub usernames to sort of play with the interface that we use. So if you filled out the feedback form yesterday, your username should be pre-populated here. If you do not see your username, email Brian. So this email right at the bottom of the screen, and he will add you to our list, and then we will have a new grid for you guys to report to your different room assignments. So make sure that you're listed. All right, So as David sort of alluded to earlier, we talk about three different axes for grading. We have correctness. And for most of you, you guys have been playing around on edX a lot, so you already are sort of familiar with the tool Check 50. And it's no coincidence that we offer Check 50 to both students and teachers. So we want students to have that instantaneous feedback, and we feel that that is like one of the most important things, is students being able to check the work for themselves. Being able to see right away, hey, I have three frowny faces, I have two smiley faces, there's something wrong. And just sort of simplifying it to that level so that they know sort of, hey, it's totally feasible for me to get a perfect score in correctness, and in fact they should if they have access to this tool. The next one that we sort of talk about is design, which thanks to the tool that we're going to show you guys later, is where you'll be spending probably most of your time grading. It's definitely the hardest of the three axes to grade. It's the most subjective. It's sort of up to you, and what you would give a student on design wouldn't necessarily be what the person next to you would give, or even your students might argue with you. And to that extent, it's a very slippery slope when you start arguing with students on score, because, you know, at what point does it end, right? So like, oh, well, I thought this was a 4. And then every other student is like, well, why isn't my grade like one number higher, right? So just sort of being consistent and really justifying your scores and how you got there is really important for students, at least. And then style is another tool that we're looking to sort of automate for you guys, so you won't have to grade style. However, both correctness and style are totally overwritable by you guys. So for instance, correctness, we have a group of students doing CS50 in Nicaragua. So they got the problem set completely translated into Spanish. And instead of printing Hello World, they print Hola Mundo. And Check 50 checks the string itself, character by character. So it's expecting Hello World, not Hola Mundo. So it's going to say that that is incorrect. Whereas you're the teacher, you know that that in practice is the same thing. So you would go in and overwrite that 0 as a 5 because you know that they're the same. In terms of style, our style guide is very specific, and we'll send you guys a link to our full style guide after this workshop. But if you prefer that your students be more consistent with themselves rather than to our style guide, that's totally cool too. And you can grade them that way if you so choose. If they prefer to have their curly braces on the same line rather than putting them on their own line, that's cool, so long as they're being consistent with themselves. And it depends on what you decide to value in your own classroom. All right, so yes. Yes. So the question was, why don't we include scope anymore? And the reason is we sort of infer scope from correctness now. Mm-hmm. So we kind of felt that it was obsolete to sort of double count that. Yeah.
The other thing I just want to add quickly is for us, we group problems into problem sets. And so it's okay, it's possible for students generally to have a fractional scope score, because they're turning in two of the three problems. Particularly for CS50 AP, we're generally focused on one problem at a time, and so if a student was to get a 0 in scope, and because scope had a multiplier effect, it would 0 the entire problem. Mm-hmm. So we've just kind of abstracted away this idea of inferring it from correctness instead, where they kind of now serve the same purpose.
Yeah, another question. So Check 50 is open source on GitHub. However, I will defer you to Brian later on sometime today. He's our Check 50 expert. So yeah, in short, yes, but it'll be a little complicated. Okay, so we have some guidelines to sort of help you. We're not just gonna throw you out and say, hey, grade your students with correctness, style, and design. Like, what does that even mean? Especially for a new computer science teacher, it's really hard to sort of just look at those words and say, I know exactly what I'm looking for. And so we've sort of had the luxury of teaching this course over a long period of time and sort of seeing a lot of the different types of responses that students will turn in and what's sort of common and what's sort of uncommon, what we feel is good design versus maybe poor design or design that needs work or improvement. And as Aaron mentioned earlier, like having students turn in the same assignments, like to sort of relearn or to create that culture of error can be really helpful for students. Like, I know I just went back and did all the CS50P sets again, and I found that I had solved them totally different ways than the first time I did this course. And they're less afraid of using things like functions or other complex structures the second time around than when they did the first time around. All right. So the important takeaway is that we don't want to punish students for one mistake in multiple axes. So that's sort of the reason why we break up grading the way we do. We know that that doesn't fit with the way that all of you grade, because you guys have all been teachers. So you have sort of like your method for your madness. I know I did when I was in when I was a math teacher. But we don't want to sort of have that stigma of, oh, I messed up and it affected my score like three different times. Or I made a mistake early on and that sort of compiled the error later on in the code, right? So we just want to hit it once and sort of have that student learn from that mistake and then improve it the next time around. So to that extent, we're sort of grading in a vacuum, right? So when you look at correctness, we're going to try and ignore style. We're going to try and ignore design. And as painful as that is, it's the best way for students to receive specific feedback. All right, so typically we use a 5-point scale. And in the grading tool that you guys will get to see later, it's sort of like a field box out of 5. So it's sort of implied that they are out of 5. We very, like, almost never give 5s, especially early on in the course. There's always room for improvement, and we don't want students to get sort of stuck in the fact that, oh, I'm the best, I don't need to improve. So at the very most, in the first couple weeks of the course, the highest we will give is 4s. And even those are pretty few and far between, just because we want students to have that continuing mindset for growth. And so it's sort of hard to instill in students that 3 is a good score, because what they see that out of 5, the percentage is like a C, right? So it's sort of like changing that mindset that these numbers aren't necessarily translating to letter grades. They are just sort of methods for us to use to sort of gear them towards the right direction. So in our course, sometimes we will actually put best instead of a 5 or better instead of a 4, just so that they don't associate those numbers with like a grade. All right, so correctness, we sort of talked about this earlier, but it's how well does your code run? So does it compile? Does it produce the right output? And check 50 is going to be our best friend for this. So again, we're grading on a score on a scale of 5. So those 4 and the 5s, that's the sweet spot, right? We want all of our students to eventually get there. The 2 and 3 is what we'd be like, good, but like, you know, you can use that improvement. And 0, 1 is, I don't know, maybe they just copied the distro code and like didn't even put any effort into actually solving the problem, or maybe solve part of the problem and eventually like it doesn't compile or something happens. So zeros and ones are a little less, we hardly see zeros and ones just because students have access to check 50. They will typically be inclined to get all of those smiley faces. All right, so we have check 50. And if you guys were here yesterday, you would have gotten to play a little bit with that in the IDE and sort of heard what's going on. It is receiving sort of a facelift. So know that it will be changing, but no need to worry about the prompts. They will be embedded into the specifications as they have been previously. So it will be changing, but very slightly, for you guys at least. Students have access to RunCheck 50. Like I mentioned earlier, that is one of like the biggest things, is that students are able to see right away, is this right, is this wrong? And so this is, like I said, suggested. Check 50 isn't going to know, oh, they didn't put the word ciphertext in front of their Visionaire prompt. Oh, that's wrong. You will. You will know that. You'll be able to look at your code and say, that was the correct output. They just didn't format it correctly because check 50 is so picky. And so you could go in and overwrite that correctness score. All right, so design is the hardest for students to understand, because especially if they're new to CS, they're not going to know what good design looks like. So it's very important for you to model in your class what good design looks like. And that's easier said than done, because there's no code that's going to be the absolute best. And in fact, design is also always changing. What's best today won't necessarily be best tomorrow. With all of the innovation that goes on, things in technology shifts pretty quickly. So again, it's the most subjective and it's always evolving. It'll also be the most time consuming, which is a good thing, right? This is the type of feedback that you want your students to get. It's thinking about why you would use a while loop instead of a for loop. Why iterating through an array might not be as good as just randomly accessing the one point that you need. And sort of really taking the time to have that conversation with them. And it's easier now more than ever with GitHub and the inline commenting and how students get that instantaneous email when you like submit a comment and they can reply and say, well, I don't understand that comment. Can you explain? And really having that conversation rather than it just being, well, you got a 3 out of 5, which isn't really helpful to students. So you guys will have a chance to play with commenting and see how that looks on cs50.me, which is our grading site. So you guys will be able to create what is called, our terminology called sections on cs50.me. And for you guys, that would be more relative to like a class. So if you have multiple classes, you would create multiple sections in cs50.me. So you would have your entire list of students for, say, your period one class in one section. All of your period two class would be in another section. And sort of split up your grading that way. So these are some of the questions that we sort of ask ourselves when we're grading design. Do I see repetition here that can be eliminated? Do I see loops that could be eliminated? And in fact, even this slide isn't really good design, right? Like I use the word could be eliminated twice. I can clean this up. Perhaps a better design score now. Is there a shorter way to accomplish the same thing? Sort of a rule of thumb that I use is if the code is shorter, it typically has better design than if it's longer. It's not always a good heuristic, but it's a good starting point, especially if you're new to coding. Should this code have been broken out into its own function? Students are not going to want to use functions right away. It's uncomfortable. It's confusing. And I know I would just put everything in main because it was simple and I knew it was going to work. If I put things in its own function, I didn't really know at the time where the error was, and that would like screw up my sort of process on how I would approach these problems. So that's another really important thing to sort of demo in your own classrooms is, you know, creating that culture of error and not being afraid to tackle those more difficult concepts, even if you're more likely to get it wrong if you do that. Being comfortable with being uncomfortable. All right, so if you can answer yes to any of these questions, you're probably not going to get a 5, right? If there's room for improvement, you know, you want to reflect that in their score just so that they know they have somewhere to go. They can go up from there. All right, so let's take a look at this. And this is, in fact, some part of someone's greedy code. So it looks like they start off with a while loop, and they have a bunch of if and else if statements. Can anyone sort of explain design-wise what might be good or bad here? Yeah.
You could increment the points outside of the if loop, right?
Yeah. If I'm incrementing coins by 1 after every if loop, I can totally just pull that out and put it at the end. Anything else?
They didn't use modular division.
Yeah, so it looks like they're just checking for all the quarters and subtracting 1 quarter at a time, which is probably pretty slow. Yeah.
So you don't need the loops at all.
Yeah, you could. So they have one large loop. They have this one big while loop. So they're checking, hey, is change greater than 0, going through all of these cases. And then once they pass through all of them, they have to go back and do the whole thing all over again and check if change is greater than 25, if change is greater than 10. So it's a little repetitive. And again, you said we have coins plus plus everywhere, so we could probably move that out. And it would look something like this if we did that. So that could be some sort of comment that you would give to your students. And again, as Doug mentioned earlier in our checking for understanding session, we want to give students actionable feedback. So we wouldn't just say, this looks repetitive. Right? We want to give them, well, what can I do? Maybe link them to an outside resource that explains it more in depth. And if you notice a bunch of your students doing this, saving it as a reply in GitHub so that you can easily access it yourself to save time when you grade. All right, so maybe this one's a little bit better. What's going on here? Yeah.
What about the magic numbers?
Yeah, they do have some magic numbers. So maybe we could use like a hash define quarters 25. That would be a good, can anyone put that in a nice sort of actionable feedback comment? How do I address the magic number issue? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they could totally write those as variables, but what's not so great about a variable is we could inadvertently change it, which might be sort of bad, like not on purpose, but say we just so happen to say quarters plus one instead of coins plus one, right? It could sort of mess things up. So we might want to You can do a constant too. I guess what I'm getting at is how would I phrase that comment? How would I make it empowering for the student to make that change? How would I address those magic numbers?
I would just write, you have magic numbers.
What if a student does, they're like, I don't know what a magic number is. Yeah, and you will definitely see students hard coding in these magic numbers, so to speak, a 25, a 10, a 5. And sort of that would be sort of a good use case for creating those long saved comments in GitHub, being like, I see you used a magic number here. Here's maybe a link to some source that explains more in depth what it is, and sort of asking them how they would fix it in future code, and maybe having them submit a change to that code, resubmitting that problem to address that.
You could point out that this is a good opportunity to use the magic number concept that we learned in week something.
Perfect. Yeah, readdressing what you talked about in lecture to sort of draw attention to that specific part of the code. All right, so we do, instead of having that big one big while loop, we've had several. So it's slightly better. We noticed here that they took advantage of the fact that we don't need to check for pennies because pennies is going to be equal to whatever's left over, that change. So we also took advantage of the fact that we can only ever have one nickel, right? Because if we have an even number of nickels, then it will be a dime. And like I mentioned earlier, that we don't need to check for pennies. All right, so this is sort of what you guys have been getting at. Well, what about modulo, right? So this is, I think, how I solved greedy when I first sort of tackled it with all of those magic numbers sort of woven in there. But edX doesn't grade for design or style, so I didn't have to worry about my score getting marked down. I just had to worry about correctness. But any ideas on even improvements on this? Because I know when I first started grading, I was like, oh, give this a 5. That's how I thought. And it doesn't have any loops. It's perfect. Do we see anything sort of repetitive that we can get rid of? I mean, yeah, we could still get into a function, but
you don't want functions, you want
more
functions. You want less functions.
You can. At this point in the course, students might not even know about functions. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you're only going to have one nickel, couldn't you skip the nickels? Or am I not
now, so I don't know if that's right.
You need to know if they exist or not. You don't, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's better, right? There are no loops. It's, in theory, what I would have considered a while ago the best possible solution. And it's leveraging this idea of division. We know that division in C is going to give us integers and not like floats. It's very short, right? So all the other ones took up the whole screen. This takes up half of the screen. So just by looking at it at first glance, I know it's probably better than the other implementations if it got the same correctness score. But is this the best? Well, in fact, there you could use some constants like we sort of alluded to earlier and plugging in quarter, dime, and nickel to make it more readable for you as a grader. But even then, we could sort of abstract out all the coin values at the top, and this might be a little bit overzealous for what we expect of our students this early in the course, but just knowing that this sort of level does exist, and that's why we sort of stray away from using fives so early on. All right, so design, we sort of weight a little bit differently just so that, because design is very hard to get a perfect on. We typically tell students that, you know, three is a great place to be. Like, do not be afraid of being at a three because it's still good. But we want them to strive for that five. We want them to continue to get better style and design and sort of use that as like a grounds for exploring what else is out there, right? What other ideas are out there? How else can I solve this problem? And even having students share different solutions that they've had, presenting, oh, hey, I noticed that you solved this problem differently than everyone else in the class. Can you share how you solved that? And that's really empowering for students, especially if they're new at CS, that they solved it in a really clever way. All right, so then we talk about style. So style is probably going to be the best thing for you guys as teachers, because when a student has good style, it is easier to read. And we've had AP teachers in the past who have said, I won't even answer any of my students' questions on their code unless it has perfect style. And having that indentation and the curly braces on their own line may seem pretty trivial, but in the end, right, it's more readable. You can definitely scan it over and sort of see more quickly what's going on or what is within a loop or some if statement, right? So it sort of breaks up the code in a nice way that makes it easier for you to see what's going on. And to that extent, commenting, right? A student that has no comments in their code, if they look at that maybe 2 weeks later, they don't even understand what they did. So it's really important to encourage them to comment, even over commenting in the early weeks of the course, just so that they get in the habit of it. But later on, sort of getting them to the sweet spot of maybe like one comment for like five lines of code or a block of code. But definitely encouraging that very early on, because it's a great habit to have to comment your code. Yes.
And
with C, there's so many different conventions, though. We've simply decided on one.
Okay. Yep. All right, so it's the next subjective, because like I said earlier, you could totally stress students being consistent with themselves over aligning to our style guide, if that's how you see it fitting into your classroom. But if you want to just use our implementation, our style guide, as your scoring, that's what the Style 50 tool will check. And it's similar to Check 50 in the regards that students have access to this tool, and they totally have instant feedback to how their style is. It sort of uses, I think it's a 5-to-1 ratio, right, of code to comment? Around there? Yeah. So for every five lines of code, there should be at least one line of commenting, and that's sort of how it grades commenting. Yeah?
Does it attempt to judge what the comments say at all?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody
variables for each problem set, but I would love it to also see teacher comments on those examples that I could like mimic at least in my first year of teaching them.
Yeah. So we do provide you with grading guidelines, and we'll share those with you via our new AP site, however that sort of takes shape. But what I like to do is I'll look at all of my students' code before I even start grading, not even sort of reading it line by line, but just high level, just sort of glance through and see what are the common things so that I can be consistent when I'm grading that problem.
Mm-hmm. Leave their GitHub repositories public for past classes so that you can look at their material.
Yeah, and that's definitely something you guys can communicate with each other. And if you guys are within close proximity of another school using CS50, we're more than happy to connect you with those teachers and sort of create a collaboration there. All right, so again, we use Style 50 as that sort of benchmark. You can take it or leave it, whether you want to use that or not. But again, it's subjective, it's suggestive, not determinative. All right, so one of the things, so again, we sort of think about these sort of questions when we're grading style. Can I easily tell the boundaries of each block? So that's one of the reasons why we have students put the curly braces on their own line, just because it makes it easier to sort of see what chunk of code goes together. Is it clear what this variable does based on its name? So you could totally have an emoji variable name, and a student might not know what that is. And like Doug mentioned earlier in yesterday's sessions, like a student was using Nordic gods as his variable names and mixed them up, whereas you could have used something like height and width, and you probably would have figured out the mistake a lot sooner just because they're more accurately named. If I don't understand C code, would I be able to tell what is happening based on comments alone? So that's sort of where we refer back to commenting and sort of early on, you know, almost encouraging over commenting. But if you gave your student to like your principal at your school or your English teacher, they should be able to understand just by the comments what is going on in this code. And then we talk about, you know, sort of what's too much, what's too little. And about 5 to 1 is sort of the sweet spot, 5 lines of code, 1 line of commenting. But just sort of a question you can ask yourself is, am I distracted by the amount of commenting? Like I've had students who literally will comment every single line. And early on I was like, that's great. Like you do you, you comment a lot. And like, I want you to comment. I don't want you to turn in code that's like not comment at all, which could sort of be what they do if you say, hey, you commented too much. They might overcompensate for that comment. But sort of, am I distracted or is it sort of just informative enough to tell me what's going on? Yeah.
What about the concept that good code comments itself? If you use the right, if you use good count defines and good variable names and good function names and a comprehensible structure, then a lot of the code will be readable.
Mm-hmm. For you, for someone who knows CS, it will be, right? For someone who doesn't know.
Name your things, if you name your functions, what they do.
Yeah. It should be, I would just say, just keep in mind someone who doesn't know CS should be able to understand it. And if it is that readable that the function totally explains itself, then maybe they don't need to comment there. But I would definitely just sort of use that question as your heuristic.
I would say, though, it is still a good habit to instill, especially as students will maybe go into industry and begin working collaboratively in teams, where that skill becomes critical to be able to communicate, you know, here's my module, how does it integrate with your module? It kind of creates documentation on its own.
Yeah. And even in your classrooms, if you're having students collaborate amongst themselves, you know, if they're both creating functions for one bigger project, they'll need to both know how this works and whether their variable names are consistent and all of that. Oh, this is fine. All right, so again, if you answer yes to any of these, you're probably not going to get a 5. But style is one of those axes that students will realize very quickly that it's so easy to get a 5 in style that they will put in the effort to get a 5 in style. And it kind of happens very quickly, yeah.
In terms of functions, if they're like 50, 70 lines long, would you also say that you should keep it shorter, or functions should do it their own thing? Or would you say it's just don't mind it yet and let it pass?
So it'll definitely depend on your own sort of grading, how you want to handle that. But you know, early on, we're encouraging students just to use functions generally. And before that, like, they won't even be using functions at all. Like Mario, they wouldn't, right? It's so early on in the course.
You don't put like a limit of, say, 25 lines of function, because it should stay consistent, or should stay very, very direct of what it does.
I mean, you could totally implement a cutoff for your own students, but we typically don't. Yeah. And then, yeah, students realize that these are easy points, and they are very good at gaming the system, so this is where they will improve first. And like I said earlier, if student has good style, it's so easy to sort of, well, it's not easy by any means to debug student's code, but it makes it easier for you, especially when you're the only CS teacher in a room of like 30 kids, right, to sort of go around. And if you see some student with messy style, you're going to be like, well, you need to fix that because I have other students that I could address their problems quickly because they have good style. This one's similar to correctness, where our 4 and our 5s are sort of our good. That's like almost no improvement. They have well-named variables. They have an appropriate amount of comments. And sort of 0, 1, and 2 is, you know, things are indented funny. There's no comments. They have weird variable names. They don't hash define their magic numbers. And sort of a large amount of those comments that address those questions on that previous slide, if you have to comment sort of a lot of those things, that's where you would give sort of in that 0, 1, or 2 range. So today you guys will be playing around with grading Greedy, Caesar, and Recover. And we'll be using the CS50 grading tool called CS50.me. And it's just going to be an exercise to sort of gain familiarity with these axes as well as the tool itself, because a lot of you haven't been able to see CS50.me because we just recently released it back in the spring. So we're going to play around with that. And each of your breakout groups will be led by one of our summer interns so that you guys will have some guidance as to you know, what kind of comments are good to leave for students, how to justify your scores, et cetera. So before we break out into groups, we just want to make sure that everything works for you guys. So if you could log on to your computers and go to cs50.me and log in with your GitHub credentials, we can sort of see from there where everyone is at. And I will actually have Brian come up and talk a little bit about what we'll be doing in our breakout groups and GitHub more generally. Yeah.